This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you on our Prairie Public Radio Network across North Dakota this time of day. Today we're going to start our show with something new at NDSU, and it's a brand new institute that's just being formed, the Challey Institute for Global Innovation and Growth, and we're going to talk with two people who are very much involved in developing this idea and getting it off the ground. Scott Beaulieu is the College of Business Dean at NDSU. Thank you for joining
Great
us
to
today.
Be on. Thank you.
And John Glover, you're the NDSU Foundation President and CEO. A pleasure to have you as well.
Doug, thanks for being here.
Let's begin at the beginning. Where did the idea originate for the Institute for Global Innovation and Growth?
It's something that came together about a year ago. Over the summer, we're in the middle of a capital campaign at NDSU, and we've been thinking about what are ideas that NDSU is uniquely positioned to be driving forward and say we want to be a leader on. And one of the things that is interesting about our history is we have an economist who went on to have amazing success throughout his career, who was an undergraduate at NDSU. His name's Mansur Olson, and he was focused on big questions throughout his career related to the wealth and poverty of countries. Why are some nations rich, others poor? Why are some parts of the world that are really entrepreneurial really struggling in terms of how people are doing in these places? You have entrepreneurial people, but they're barely surviving. So he was fascinated with this. He was an NDSU student as an undergraduate. He would have won a Nobel Prize had he not died prematurely about 20 years ago.
Harvard and Oxford educated.
Yes, yeah. And we thought that this is someone that's part of our roots as an institution. And what if we focused our energy around asking the questions that Mansur was asking throughout his career? So we went from that anchoring starting point to saying, you know, we have big issues related to the wealth and poverty in our region. We have workforce issues that are tremendous in terms of not having enough good people here to staff the 30,000 jobs that currently are vacant. Why not tackle these questions of what's holding back our state and our region?
All right. Well, that is an interesting idea. And, John, it fell at the right time, I guess, for fundraising, right?
It sure did, Doug. And a couple things that are happening in philanthropy today is that donors are increasingly savvy. They're increasingly more sophisticated and thoughtful about what they want to do with their resources that can make a difference in the world. And oftentimes those drive to really big ideas that can affect societal change, can global change, community change, those kinds of things. And oftentimes those ideas sit at the intersections of traditional academic disciplines. And this idea that Scott was talking about was one that as the concept bubbled up, we had a couple of benefactors who we introduced the idea to. And as Bob Challey said in our gift announcement event a couple of weeks ago, he read about half of the concept, put it down, called us and said, that's it. That's what we want to do. We want to be a leader in helping to launch this institute and solve the problems that Scott was talking about, explore the questions and really make a difference in the lives of students that NDSU is graduating and certainly the communities.
And major benefactors are Sheila and Robert Challey.
Sure.
And the Charles Koch Foundation.
That's correct. So it's a collection of support from benefactors, but it's led by Sheila and Bob Challey and the Charles Koch Foundation. So the Challey's roots, Bob's roots are right here in Fargo, grew up in town, family, spent time on campus, taught on campus. Bob went to school here. Has an undergraduate degree from NDSU in chemistry, went off to California and a successful career, but he's long been involved with the university and is well known. And as Scott alluded to, we are in the early phases of a new philanthropic campaign to advance excellence at NDSU, and this now will be one of the cornerstone projects that's a part of that effort.
And people will recognize that name, Challey, because it's the Challey School of Music
that's correct.
Been at NDSU for several years now. So the mission of this new institute is to grow entrepreneurship, study trade, create opportunities worldwide and in the region. How will you go about putting it together?
Yeah, so the design for the institute is for it to be a transdisciplinary program that hires 15 tenure-track faculty members, which is a really big number of people to hire. We think that tackling questions of trade, immigration, opportunity are ones that aren't unique to just one discipline. Figuring out and cracking the nut of what's holding back the Midwest, what's holding back our country.
Interdisciplinary seems to be the
exactly.
The trend, right?
And we want to support hiring of people just interested in these questions anywhere on campus. So it'll be housed in the College of Business. We're going to hire professors who are tackling these questions, but we'll support work being done in this area anywhere. It could be sociology, it could be political science, it could be health, engineering, and a lot of other disciplines. On campus. So it's really meant to be a hub for people interested in working with us. And there will be graduate assistantships and a lot of programming, too. One of the first things we'll be doing is just some very quick conferences and programs to talk about things that we hope that the Institute faculty are interested in. So a conference on immigration. My wife and I moved here 3 years ago. We're completely floored by how diverse and amazing this area is, and we think that more immigration in the Midwest is probably going to be critical to our future, and we want scholars looking at that and seeing if indeed our hunch is correct.
It seems to me that one critical component of this new institute is a visionary leader.
Absolutely.
So what kind of a search do you anticipate?
We're going to be looking right away for leadership of the institute because that person is going to be helping with recruitment of the 15 faculty members. I will have a hand in this as well. You know, to put in perspective this gift, it's historic, and the president of the university, Dean Bresciani, has been talking about the historic magnitude of the gift, but it's almost equal to the budget of my entire college. So we need some really great people that help us stand the institute up.
That gets to another issue here, John, and that is that the higher education funding model has really radically changed over the years. And nowadays, philanthropy is more important than it has ever been.
Yeah, that's right, Doug. You know, a place like NDSU, when we think about its annual operating budget, it gets, generally speaking, it gets about a quarter of its dollars from state appropriations.
And those are hard fought.
And generally, over time, whether we like it or not, that trend is going down. And we are not unique in that space. It's occurring around the country. About a quarter of our revenue comes from tuition that we charge students. And, of course, there's an interest to keep that reasonable so that families can afford and send their kids to college. And then the other half of the revenue comes through things like residence life, dining, auxiliary services, research contracts, the opportunities that come about in a research university, and then other sources. And philanthropy is increasingly a catalyst and an important factor to be able to stitch together the mission of the institution. Philanthropy is also at the edges of advancing excellence in the institution. And back to what I said earlier, donors want to see impact. They want to know that their gifts are making a difference and that they are advancing the excellence of an institution or the nonprofit that they get involved with. And so oftentimes there are some stakeholders that might suggest that philanthropy can replace the things that just run the day-to-day life of whatever organization it is. And increasingly, donors are not interested in that, but they will make big investments, and you'll get significant opportunities about that. But it's about advancing excellence in the institution. And one other comment about why this aligns with NDSU so well is NDSU is a research university, and in order for its livelihood to sustain well into the future, we really need to be excellent in research. And excellence in research at the intersection of the disciplines of all the programs that we offer, the liberal arts kinds of programs, the things that we do in the physical sciences, agriculture, engineering. And the interesting thing I think about, you know, when we think about a College of Business, some might think, well, that's a discipline. Well, all of our industries are business. So business is at the heart of the intersection of disciplines, and the Challey Institute being centered here makes all kinds of sense.
Well, let's talk about another piece of governance here. You need an executive director, a visionary leader. You probably also need a board of directors, because there will be ongoing issues, including fundraising, that will be important to sustain the Institute. So how are you going to make those selections?
Yeah, so I think we have a lot of support just through the philanthropists who have given. So, you know, John mentioned our lead donors, but there's a network of supporters that is probably something like 20 deep, who primarily want to be anonymous, but they want to help in any way that they can in helping to drive the, you know, kind of drive the focus of the Institute and help us wherever we need help in bringing in guest speakers, in connecting the Institute students with opportunities in the area, and really being a source of feedback on what are the things holding back our state and our region. You know, our goal for the Institute at a very high level is to help address and solve the workforce issues that the states of Minnesota and North Dakota do. So measure us in 10 years by whether we're putting a dent in this problem that is endemic to our area. I think we're losing opportunities for major employers to come, and we're frankly losing really good people due to the fact that it's really hard to recruit and attract in this area. You know, let's tackle that from a research standpoint, and then let's be measured on whether we're actually making a difference. And our advisory board is going to be absolutely critical in just being that sounding board for we think you're on the right track with this particular program or this direction of research.
And I think you could say in any century, and at least in the modern era, you could have said that it's important to look at global innovation and growth, but never more than the 21st century, because we are a global economy now. That's
right. And, you know, if you look back at the last summer, just this, it became very political, and there was a lot of shouting back and forth about trade. And North Dakota is one of the states that is most susceptible to the trade winds. And our students barely know that. They go and they get a really great education, but they have no idea that if they stay in North Dakota or Minnesota, they're going to be extremely susceptible to whatever happens with these global forces that are called international markets. And we want to expose them to that reality, that for a state that's maybe the fourth largest in the United States, we're punting way beyond the coverage in terms of our reliance on exports and our reliance on trade. So let's teach them up in this area and, you know, just have them much more prepared for the reality that's waiting.
And take advantage of the word university, because we have been talking interdisciplinary here. Mm-hmm. And just to build on what you've said, the news release that I saw from NDSU indicated that there would be faculty positions representing economics, engineering, education, entrepreneurship, finance, political science, public policy, and sociology. Wow.
Yep. Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yep.
And that's a lot of interdisciplinary stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's a university within a university.
And that's kind of the vision for it. Yep.
So how do you govern something like this when you've got major donors, John, who are invested now in the university, in the Institute? How do you keep them sort of at arm's length in a way so that they aren't dictating what things become but are, you know, involved but not ordering people around?
Yeah, sure. Well, it takes strong leadership and from all sides on the institution. And one of the ways and things that we as a foundation do in working with donors, whether it's this project or scholarship support or other faculty or building support or programmatic support, is that when we sit down with a benefactor, we will sit down and really ask the questions, what would you like to do with your money? It's most important to you. And as we navigate that conversation, what will evolve is an investment or a gift that a donor will make, and they'll have thoughts about how they want that gift to be utilized. And we will draw that up in a gift agreement. And the gift agreement is something that the donor, the foundation, the university all agree to.
It's a form of contract.
It's a contract. That's exactly right. And donor intent is very important here. But there are lines about how far that, you know, donor direction can go, and that's the importance of a gift agreement to define those things out. And so that's why it's really important. That's why giving today is intensely a personal conversation with each donor. What has made this project unique, as Scott alluded to, is we have a collection of donors. This investment is the single largest investment in faculty and students at NDSU in its history. I mean, there have been big gifts before for other projects, building facilities, but when it comes to faculty, this is it, and it'll be exciting.
That's John Glover, NDSU Foundation President and CEO. We're also talking with Scott Bollier. He is the NDSU College of Business Dean, about the Challey Institute for Global Innovation and Growth. More in a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota Pool Trust, offering investment options for people with disabilities that protect eligibility for public benefits. Services available in Minnesota and North Dakota. Learn more at lssmn.org/trusts. And by the Bush Foundation, introducing the North Dakota recipients of the 2019 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2019 Bush Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we're talking about the Challey Institute for Global Innovation and Growth with John Glover, the NDSU Foundation CEO, and Scott Bollier, the College of Business Dean at NDSU. And Scott, I'm going to start with you here. This announcement was made earlier this month. Mm-hmm. When is the Institute going to be fully realized?
My goodness, it's going to take a few years to be to pull 15 faculty on board, and we want to be very intentional about that and make sure that we're attracting a group that fits together and gels well as a team. But you'll start to see programming already in the coming weeks and months. Next week, for example, we're hosting Minneapolis Fed President Neil Kashkari. He'll be in on Wednesday. That Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis is doing a lot of the things that we aspire to do as well, talking about opportunity and talking about what's holding back the state of Minnesota. And we're going to be working with them a lot as a networked partner throughout the Institute's development. So it's you know, something this big is going to require a lot of building out, but it's already beginning.
Well, NDSU has more than 14,000 students now. I know it's always interested in growing a bit. When this is fully realized, the Institute is up and running, how many students do you expect to be taking classes under it?
Yeah, so our goal is to reach every student on campus, and
that's
a lot. That's a really big goal, you know, and that doesn't mean teaching every student. It means just impacting them some way through attendance at some of our events, you know, taking a course here or there. I think that when you look at just the numbers that were built in, there's 20 graduate fellowships, and that's a lot of PhD and master's students that we're going to be supporting. There's significant support for undergraduates, but then there's all of the things that you can't quite imagine yet of having that many professors trying to take their programming of the university in directions they're passionate about and want to go. So could we have graduate programming we can't even imagine yet? Absolutely. And I think that that's all something that'll happen organically when they're here and when they're driving the curriculum. So could we have a PhD program in things that Mansur Olson was passionate about, political economy or, you know, something related to economics that, you know, just goes full circle and comes back to this Buxton, North Dakota kid and, you know, someone who grew up on a farm and took off and had an amazing career. Could we go and, you know, help cultivate and develop the next Mansur right here at North Dakota State again? I think we can. And I think it's just a matter of daring to be imaginative.
And having perhaps a broader public comfort with words like capitalism and socialism.
being comfortable talking about those things instead of shouting.
Yeah,
and that's what we aim to do.
Exactly. John, in the old ivory tower days, which were imaginary to begin with, you know, presidents and deans were, you know, in charge of the intellectual development of those students, and that was that. That was it. But nowadays, they're very deeply involved in fundraising, too. So what do you expect from a president and from a dean when you go out and try to, you know, curry some favor for the institution?
Yeah, it's a great question. And without there is no doubt that the life of a university president and the life of a dean at a university like NDSU has changed dramatically in terms of the job description. And I think if you ask Scott the question when he was hired going through the process 3 years ago, and it was, what are you asking for from the next dean of the College of Business? one of the primary responsibilities was build relationships, external relationships, and raise money. If you go back a decade, if you go back 20 years, those job descriptions look very, very different. Today, it's the same thing with the university president. He or she is the face of the institution. That's about building external relationships. And certainly relationships with private benefactors is paramount. And so a tremendous amount of energy and effort is involved in those roles in the external world. And for the foundation and for my role and for my staff, our job is to help facilitate the relationships that the president, the provost, the deans are going to have with stakeholders that care about their respective programs. And, you know, with all due respect, presidents and deans and people like me come and go, but the relationship that a donor is going to have with the institution will remain forever, and often that office that they care most about and that program. And so our role is to help facilitate that.
Well, I understand that more and more department chairs, for that matter, professorships, and even deans are endowed. And you are the Ronald and Kay Olson Dean of Business, Scott. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the support for faculty and the leadership. Are they bound by the same wage and benefit guidelines as the rest of the university, or does an institute status offer some more leeway there?
I think there's a lot more room to support excellence, and that's what philanthropy allows. The endowed deanship is really focused on giving me the resources to make strategic calls that I otherwise wouldn't be able to make. So if I want to pull the trigger on something or be experimental, I now have a fund that allows me to do that. And most deans don't have that. Their hands are truly tied. And so when someone comes to them and says, I want to do something, it is an honest answer when they say, I can't. I don't have the resources. I now suddenly have the opportunity, thanks to the Olson gift, to say, well, I might be able to help you. And what an amazing grant of flexibility that is for myself and for future deans at NDSU. Faculty will enjoy that same opportunity if they interact and work with the institute, the chance for summer support, the chance for rewards for just outstanding, impactful research, the opportunity to be supported if they can communicate their research to larger audiences, which is a really big theme of the institute, is let's not let research just die on the shelf or be talked about among academics only. Let's bridge it and make it relevant to the stakeholders we fundamentally serve. If they're doing that and hitting it out of the park, the dollars from philanthropy reward them to a much greater extent.
And the state's commodity economic model, you know, it's either ag or it's oil and gas these days, might add maybe a little intellectual brain power as well as an important commodity.
Absolutely.
Does an institute like this put the university in a better position to get grant money?
I'll take a stab at that, and the answer is absolutely yes. The Challey Institute will raise the profile and status and stature of the institution. It will attract excellence in terms of new faculty, either young, aspiring faculty that are growing their careers. There's going to be opportunity to hire real superstars in their respective disciplines, and all of those will bring additional opportunities in terms of investment for research and then learning for our students. So what's the saying, the rising tide raises all boats, right? That is what's going to happen with the Challey Institute. And just one other comment about the Olson deanship. The establishment of the Olson Dean of the College of Business is the very first of its kind here at NDSU. And we want to establish such a deanship for all of the academic colleges. But again, Scott Beaulieu is now able to go around the country whenever he's attending seminars or being asked to speak in other places. He will be introduced as the Ronald and Kay Olson Dean of the College of Business and at NDSU. And that's a big deal.
All right. Well, we're talking about the Challey Institute for Global Innovation and Growth. It's coming to NDSU, and we've been talking about it with John Glover, whose voice you just heard, the foundation president and CEO for NDSU, and Scott Beaulieu, the College of Business Dean at NDSU. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks, Doug.
Great to be on. Thank you.
Coming up next on Main Street, Chuck Lura answers the question, how do you know how old a fish is? First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. For flood fighters in Grand Forks and East Grand Forks, it's still a little bit of a waiting game. Officials on both sides of the river have been readying for water to spill over the banks of the Red and Red Lake rivers this spring. Up to this point, much of the work has been about planning. East Grand Forks Public Works Director Jason Stordahl says there are indications things are beginning to open up. Stordahl says water is beginning to enter the ditches. Some black is starting to show in area fields, and the river is getting wet around the edges.
We'll just be monitoring day by day and hour by hour and making decisions on closures as that happens. So also working closely with Grand Forks on the Demers closure, on the Point Bridge closure.
National Weather Service is expected to issue an updated hydrological outlook for snowmelt today. The state Senate has passed a bill inspired by a child abuse case in West Fargo that occurred about a year and a half ago. Republican Senator Dick Dever carried the bill on the Senate floor.
The perpetrator clenched his fist and he struck his two-month-old child in the face. And he pulled back and he took another swing. And he broke a rib and broke an arm. There is no sympathy in this place for that perpetrator.
House Bill 1395 would include a parental capacity evaluation, a mental health evaluation, and an anger management assessment in the sentencing of individuals convicted of child abuse. It was passed on the Senate floor unanimously last week, but was then referred to the Appropriations Committee with a fiscal note of $371,000. The committee decided discretion for these evaluations should be left up to a judge instead of mandated by the state and recommended do not pass on a vote of 9-5. But after receiving emails from the public, Dever said every last committee member who voted against the bill in committee changed their minds.
In this case, the perpetrator was charged and then convicted of a Class B felony. He served some time with an ankle bracelet and then a total of 12 days in jail. His visitation of the child was to be under supervised visitation for a year, and this coming fall, unsupervised. The perpetrator continues to pursue his parental rights. It would seem that the only remorse involved in this situation would be in the minds of the 9 members of Appropriations that thought that we should leave this to the judge.
The bill was passed 45-0. It had earlier passed the House and now awaits Governor Burgum's signature. And the penalty for texting and driving in Minnesota could be going up. A House committee heard testimony this week on legislation to increase fines for using wireless communication device to text while operating a motor vehicle. Representative Bob Detmer says the bill is designed to save lives.
And the Minnesota Department of Public Safety reported that between 2013 and 2017, one in five crashes in the state was from distracted driving. On the average, 53 people were killed each year as a result of distracted driving.
Detmer says young drivers appear to be at greatest risk.
The AAA Foundation states that cell phone use while driving is the highest among 16 to 24-year-olds drivers. And this bill also requires information on distracted driving and its dangers to be part of the driver's education programs and the driver's training manual.
Lawmakers are also looking at a ban on using mobile devices behind the wheel without a hands-free device. The proposed texting fines include $150 for a first offense, $300 for a second offense, and $500 for a third or subsequent offense. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura used to teach college biology. He still teaches with his Natural North Dakota essays. And today Chuck tells us how to determine the age of a fish.
I happened to see a picture of a scale of a fish recently, illustrating the age of the fish. Being able to age a fish could help fisheries managers with a variety of aspects of fisheries management, such as estimating growth rates, survival, and longevity. It could also help better understand the aspects of habitat, food abundance and availability, and a myriad of other factors. But how would you age a fish? Most everyone knows that the age of a tree can be estimated by counting growth rings. Growth rings in trees are a phenomenon of temperate climates and are the result of seasonal activity of the cambium. Variations in how the cells are produced in an annual increment of wood, for example, cell density and cell wall thickness, differ between what is called spring wood and summer wood. It's a reflection of the seasonality of the growing conditions of the year. As a result, these observable growth rings can be used to age trees. Just as the age of a tree can be estimated by counting the growth rings, a similar technique can be used to age fish. Because fish are cold-blooded, In temperate climates, they typically put on most of their growth during the warmer months and very little growth during the colder months. These differences in growth rate are recorded in some structures in the fish in much the same way as the growth rings are in trees. Several techniques have been developed for aging fish, and these techniques use various parts of the fish. For some fish species, the otoliths, or ear stone, can be used to estimate age. For other species, the fin rays are used to estimate the age. A thin section of the vertebrae can also be used. However, these techniques usually require the fish to be dead or killed for age determination. However, a method involving the collection and analysis of fish scales can be used to determine the age of a live fish. The number of scales on a fish doesn't change. However, as the fish grows, the size of the scales changes, and those changes occur in observable ways. At the edge of a fish's scale is a light little ridge. When growth is slow, for example during the winter, these ridges are close together. Conversely, when growth is rapid, such as what you would expect during the summer months, the ridges are more spaced apart. So with a little training in a microscope or dissecting scope, a person can learn to identify an annual increment in the scale and thus age a fish. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Jade Presents, bringing Nitty Gritty Dirt Band to the Belle Mayhews Auditorium on Thursday, August 8th. You and me go fishing in the dark. Tickets are on sale now at the Bismarck Event Center box office, by phone at 800-514-3849, or online at jadepresents.com or etix.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Ashley Thornburg is here with me in our Fargo studio. And in Bismarck, we've got Sue Balcom.
Sue, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. I heard it's almost spring.
Yeah. And what are you doing in the garden?
Oh, yay. I'm so excited. Well, you know, most people that garden start in December, like I've probably mentioned before, by cruising seed catalogs, but March is the time to begin thinking about getting some of your starts or your little transplants started. Whether you have like a huge garden or you're maybe only going to plant one little pot or two of tomatoes this summer, I got some tips and hints for you to get those little babies going.
Well, start with how do we get the soil right for what we're going to grow?
Well, you can purchase growing medium from your local stores, and you're going to find it, you know, at places like Menards and Lowe's and stuff. They're starting to stock their garden supply sheds already. So you want to go and find some good organic soil or growing medium. What you don't want to do is you do not want to purchase anything that says it's topsoil or garden soil, because your soil indoors when you start your little seedlings needs to be sterilized. Because I grow so many plants, like I've probably got 200 pepper plants already up an inch, and I planted at least 70 tomato plants the other day, and I'm going to probably do another couple flats this weekend. But I kind of mix my own soil medium up. And so if you have, you know, like I keep, okay, I'm going to admit to this, I keep a box of dirt in my front porch all year round, you know, in the event that you need to smell it or transplant a plant or something.
Yeah, well, I see the value in it as I look at piles of snow out there.
Right,
I'd like to be reminded of dirt myself.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, soon and very soon. So I mix it out of vermiculite, a quarter. Like, let's say you were measuring out a quarter part of vermiculite, a quarter cup of peat moss, and then half, the other half is sterilized soil. And what that does is it kind of breaks your soil up so it's not so hard and the plants get off to a better start. As you know, all seeds contain what they need to begin life in a healthy way. So that little tiny tomato or pepper seed is packed with nutrients. So you do not need to add fertilizer at this point in time. You do not need to use fertilized potting soil, and certainly do not buy any I'm getting in trouble for this. Don't buy the potting soil that has the little microbeads of moisture in, because plants don't like to keep their feet wet. They don't mind getting their feet wet, but they don't want to be soaking in water all the time.
That's a good tip, because I've been seeing that everywhere now.
Yeah.
I've had more plants rot out, more root rot, because of that moisture that is held in the soil because of those little beads. And they're the beads that are in diapers, so think about that. Anyway, you can, you should be starting things like peppers, onions, and maybe some herbs if you like to have early herbs. And tomato plants, about now is a good time to start. You do not want to start cucumbers, green beans, squash, those kinds of things until later, because you cannot keep them alive long enough in your house. We are in zone 4A where I'm at, but I think in Fargo you guys are probably more a 3 or a 3A.
Well, we wish right now.
Which means that your growing season is a little bit shorter. And so pick varieties of plants that have 60 days to maturity, and you'll have much more success with that.
So you mentioned sterilized soil. What does that mean?
Correct. That means that there's nothing in that soil that is alive at the moment, because you don't want any kinds of little viruses or little bugs or little things damping off your new transplants. So if your plants come up, your little seedlings come up, and they're like really, really happy, but then all of a sudden you see that their waistlines are getting skinnier right at the soil there, that's damping off, and that's caused by some little tiny viruses that are in unsterilized soil, which is why you cannot use garden soil, bags, or topsoil to start your little plants. So if you can get a good organic potting soil, or if you only have, like, let's say, soil from outside, you can sterilize it yourself by putting it on a tray and putting it in your oven. But it really stinks, and so you might not want to do that.
How hot do you,
Just kind of like, you're just kind of like roasting it, like maybe
250. Roasted dirt.
Roasted dirt.
Low and slow, huh?
Low and slow. Yep, that's it. Kill those suckers off.
Oh, right.
So you don't want to, definitely you got to watch what soil you're using, and it really helps to add vermiculite and peat to it so that it stays loose, because when it's all compacted, that can dampen off your plants also. Another thing you want to do is, let's say you don't have a lot of room. You can plant those, you can start seeds in egg cartons, or you can actually use a half an eggshell in an egg carton, because eggs have calcium and protein, and those shells are really good for tomato seedlings. You can use tin cans. You can use waxy milk cartons. You can use plastic milk cartons. Just remember to put some drainage holes in the bottom and put them on a plate so that the water, when you water them, has a chance to drain out, because you want the soil to be moist, but you don't want it to be oversaturated. And my husband sent me this thing about planting plants in, like, ice cream cones. And I'm like, yeah, that's a super good idea. Have you ever seen what happens to an ice cream cone when it gets wet from melted ice cream?
Yes. It's the best part of the day.
I'm very familiar with this.
You would pick that up, and there would go your plant out the bottom end. So do not use ice cream cones to plant your seeds in. You can roll your own paper pots, and I do have a little video that shows how to roll a paper pot. They're biodegradable. They're readily available because everybody has newspapers that they can get their hands on. Do not use shiny newspaper. And when you bury those things in your garden, be sure to bury them below the soil line, because if you leave any of your pot out, that paper will suck up all the moisture away from your plant. Well, but that's getting ahead of myself.
Well, speaking of which, you've mentioned water. What is the best way, the best timing, and all that sort of stuff for water?
Okay, so you have to keep your, especially critical in the early days until they get a couple leaves, that soil has to remain moist. What I do is I take a pot and I fill it with water and let it set next to a radiator, so it's warm. They like warm water. They like water that doesn't have chlorine in it. So if you let it set, the chlorine comes out of it. And just recently, I started throwing a banana peel or two in my pot because bananas make water a little bit. Potassium and stuff like that will leach out of the banana into your water, and that makes your plants happy.
Well, there's a tip.
And it has to drain. Don't forget it has to drain. Something else that you need to do that people never think about is strengthen the stems on your plants. So you can do one of two things. One of them is simply put a fan on them so that there's air circulating.
Oh.
This will strengthen them.
Smart.
But I brush mine singly with my hand, you know, like I gently go over the tops of them and I tell them, you know, I'm swaying in the wind, you know, just kind of, and that makes them sturdier.
I just had an interesting picture in my head.
My husband's like, are you talking to me or are you talking to your plants? I'm like, well, I'm talking to my plants. So.
Are they talking back?
Okay, and I forgot, the most important thing that those little plants need is light. This is a common error that if you're growing leggy plants, like they're all stem and no leaves, they are not getting enough light. So invest in an $11 shop light. Buy one cool fluorescent bulb and one hot fluorescent bulb, warm fluorescent bulb, because they're not hot, and put those right over the top of those little seedlings. And as they grow, move the lights up, but keep them as close as possible without touching. And you will have happy, happy transplants, and we'll talk more about how to get those in the garden when the snow finally melts.
And if somebody wants to follow you, Sue, how do they do that?
They can find me on my website at therootsellers.com. And there's a special blog page, and there's all kinds of videos, and you can ask me questions. And there's also a link to this episode sooner or later as a downloadable podcast. And there's a link to that also on that webpage.
Main Street Eats with
Main
Sue Balcom.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, guys.
What's happening is next.
On the next episode of Threshold. This is what it sounds like to walk on one of the two great ice sheets remaining on the planet.
It's a pretty interesting surface with this honeycomb. I mean, half of what we're walking around on is not ice. It's whole.
Join us on the Greenland Ice Sheet next time on Threshold.
Threshold, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
That's the question we ask every Thursday. Ashley Thornburg and I look at our calendars and what is coming up for the weekend.
How about farmers markets? It's so exciting to start thinking that we are into the farmers market season. Okay, not the traditional lots of vegetables and everything being harvested, but there is a spring market this Saturday, March 30th in Moorhead at the Moorhead Center Mall. This is a place where you can stock up on pantry items, household goods, baked goods. There's even going to be some art and some food and beverages. This is the Red River Spring Market this Saturday, the 30th, in Moorhead at the Moorhead Center Mall from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's free to get in, and what you spend is up to you, I guess.
Well, here's a little market for the birds. It's a bird feeding workshop Saturday in Battle Lake at Glendalough State Park. Because spring is in the air, you may feed the birds during the winter. From spring to late summer is a good time to feed some migrant species. Learn about the ruby-throated hummingbird and the bird named the Baltimore Oriole. That's the bird, not the game, the team, I should say. This two-hour workshop will include building an oriole feeder to take home. It runs from 10 until noon at Glendalough State Park Saturday. That's near Battle Lake, and the cost is $7.
Well, I'll stick with animals. For bouncing bunnies this Saturday, the 30th, in Bismarck at the Dakota Zoo. This is geared at the little tykes and for the young at heart as well. This is an animal adventure for kids mostly about 3 to 4 years old, give or take. Coming up this Saturday, again, the 30th in Bismarck at the Dakota Zoo, as people will have fun learning about their special animal friends. Kids also get a chance to make a craft item. And this is from 1:30 to 2:30, and the cost for this event is $16. $15.
The Wonderful Wizard of Oz Ballet is Friday in Grand Forks at the Empire Arts Center. The North Dakota Ballet Academy apprentice dancers will debut The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. This ballet is based on the classic tale written by L. Frank Baum and brought to life through dance by ballet director Lauren Paulson. So you'll see Dorothy, the Tin Man, Scarecrow, and Cowardly Lion on their journey down the yellow brick road with a little ballet. From 7 to 9 on Friday at the Empire Arts Center, the cost, $15.
There is a youth art show this Friday, the 29th, in Sydney, Montana, at the Mondack Heritage Center. This youth art show features artwork from 7th to 12th grade students in the Sydney area, who are working in lots of different kinds of mediums here, from acrylic paintings to charcoal drawings, pottery, and much more. And you even get the opportunity to vote for the People's Choice Award in each of those grades. So support these young artists 1 to 4 p.m. on Friday in Sydney, Montana, at the Mondack Heritage Center, and it's free.
A fun show coming to the Fargo Theater, Church Basement Ladies Rise Up, O Men. It's Saturday in downtown Fargo at the theater. There are Houses of the Holy. However, the Fargo Theater will be a fun house when a touring production of Church Basement Ladies takes the stage. It's one of the newer installments in the Church Basement Ladies franchise. That is Rise Up, O Men. So a little gender equality. From 2 in the afternoon and 7 in the afternoon on Saturday, it's $38 plus fees.
The Abbey Road Show this Saturday, the 30th, in Detroit Lakes at the Historic Holmes Theater, as the band Collective Unconscious plays this album, one of the greatest albums of all time. They are going to play it straight through from start to finish with songs like Here Comes the Sun, which is a great song anytime, but especially this time of year. Come Together, Octopus's Garden. You can listen to this whole album performed live. Okay, not by the Beatles, but hey, it's being performed live by local talent in Detroit Lakes at the Historic Holmes Theater. 7:30 to 9 p.m. Tickets are $28 this Saturday.
The annual video game swap-off is Saturday in Fargo at the Ramada. This event provides an outlet for video game collectors of all ages and styles to come together in one room and simply trade video games for any console or any year of manufacture. Wow. You can bring games to trade and meet people with similar interests, or just show off a prize piece from your collection. It's from 1 till 5 in the afternoon on Saturday in Fargo, again at the Ramada. The cost is free to show off your game and swap a game, perhaps.
All right, my pick of the week is the YWCA's Stand Against Homelessness. This is happening in Minot this Saturday at the Dakota Square Mall. There are so many struggles that are associated with homelessness, whether it's chronic or acute homelessness, and you can learn about the struggles of being homeless and, frankly, probably be surprised at who is impacted by homelessness and the various causes behind it. This is from noon to 3. This educational portion is free, but they are also accepting donations for some of the most needed shelter items. So this would include some long-lasting food, but then also there are things like toiletries, towels, bedding, and everything that can help people get back on their feet. This is Saturday the 30th in Minot at the Dakota Square Mall, noon to 3.
The Woodlands and High Plains Traditional Powwow is coming to Concordia College. It switches campuses every year in the Fargo-Moorhead area. This year it's at the Memorial Auditorium at Concordia. Saturday, the 30th anniversary of the celebration could be the biggest and best in some time. More than 200 dancers and thousands of fans, this does draw a crowd, will gather to watch the colorful processions, competitions, and hear the drum circles. It runs from noon until 10 p.m. on Saturday with the grand entries. These are very colorful, lots of fun to watch, at 1 and 7 p.m. The cost is $3 to $5. You'll get a kick out of it. That's what's happening.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 28th. In the early days of settlement in the West, it was common for livestock to run loose. Horses, cattle, sheep, and pigs wandered at will. Free-range laws generally put the responsibility on the landowner to erect fences and to keep out livestock that were legally at large. but the owner of the animals was still responsible for damages if the livestock broke through the fence. But as the human population grew, stray animals became more of a problem, wandering into gardens to eat and trample the crops. They even drifted into towns and walked the streets, which became a greater danger as cars became more common. Something had to be done. On this date in 1913, North Dakota newspapers printed the details of a law passed by the state legislature. Going forward, with few exceptions, it would now be unlawful for stock to run free. No stallions, bulls, boars, or rams would be allowed to run loose. For other stock, county commissioners were given some latitude. They could establish stock districts where other animals could roam. This could be particular sections of land or even the entire county. The commissioners could also limit those districts to certain dates. Landowners could post a sign at any gate to their property stating that anyone opening a gate had to close it. To leave a gate open when the notice was posted would violate the law. If an animal escaped through such a gate, the person who opened it would be subjected to a fine of no less than $10 and no more than $50. They would also be liable for any damages caused by the animal that got out. When settlers first came west, they found little material for fencing. But by the time of this law, barbed wire had become commonplace, making the law practical and the wide open spaces less open. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
It was an incredible honor in 2014 to be at the White House to be awarded the National Humanities Medal. And I felt that the inscription, which meant so much to me, that the medal was for thoughtfully delving into the mysteries of human existence. To me, this showed that in the years in which On Being has been in the world and growing up on public radio, our culture has also come to a place where we're ready to develop a vocabulary of the mysteries of human existence. I think that we understand together a bit better than we did even 10 years ago. That these questions of what it means to be human and who we will be to each other are also going to underpin the flourishing of all of our other disciplines, how we create neighborhoods, how we create policies, how we build schools and prisons and hospitals, and how we are as parents and neighbors and citizens. I'm Krista Tippett. I hope you'll join me for On Being, Sunday nights at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on Prairie Public.
On the next morning edition, the Trump administration is proposing different ways to lower drug prices. But will the plans actually save people money?
You know, it can't be underestimated the amount of change this is.
Also, can a device in your brain instantly reset your mood?
It was just like a massage, a shot of bourbon, and someone telling you you won $1 million.
News plus stories that expand your world. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, we'll hear from 2019 Bush Fellowship winner Jana Gipp, Chief Executive Officer of the healthcare facility that serves the Native population within the Standing Rock Nation and surrounding communities. And News Director Dave Thompson will offer his Friday analysis of the week's big stories. And then Matt Olean will review Us, the new horror film from director Jordan Peele. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.